Hello, my name is Karen Hebert, and the date today is August 17th, 2014. And I'm here in Dillingham, Alaska, with Hjalmar Ofai Olsen, who can introduce himself. Ofai, why don't you tell us when and where you were born and some details about your early life?
Well, I was born in Kanakanak Hospital right down here. There was quite a few people living there back then. They had a BIA school, of course, the hospital. The orphanage was closed. My mom was raised in that orphanage. And my dad was also born in Kanakanak. I went to school there for a year or two, and then they closed it up, and we went to school at Dillingham, up in Dillingham.
And
Yeah.
what year was that?
1940, 46, 7. Yeah. And let's see. I stayed with my parents were out trapping in back here, river, and I had to stay with my aunt and go to school. That was school age, you know. And I stayed 2 years with her, 2 years up there. Yeah.
And where did she live?
She was a clerk at the Fisherman's Co-op store. They had an apartment upstairs, which is real handy because I was walking distance to school. Yeah.
What about your brothers and sisters?
They were too young to go to school, so they went out on a trap line with my dad. I stayed in the cabin. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe you can tell us more about what things were like then and how Dillingham and Bristol Bay have changed over the years since, in your memory.
Well, we had three stores uptown. There was the Dillingham Commercial, or the Felder and Gale store, and we had Low Trading Company, and then we had Fisherman's Co-op. And three big stores, all doing pretty good. They bought furs and they had general merchandise. World Trading Company had the Standard Oil franchise selling oil there, which they still do today. It was a community of about, 500 people maybe. Nowadays it's 2,200,
It's grown a
so it's
bit.
really grown. Well, of course, we got way better roads, airport, hospital. We got a good school, and we got an incorporated city here, and they provide police, fire protection, and clean the roads around town.
How did people get around if there weren't as many roads back then?
All by dog team.
Wow.
Well, they had this 5 mile road from Dillingham down to Kanakanak, and then they had the 4 mile road to Wood River, and that was all the roads we had. Not too many cars in town, and in the wintertime, people mostly traveled by dog team. Dog team. And of course airplanes too. Mostly people would come in with their dog teams from the village and shop a little bit, maybe sell some fur and then go back home again.
So did a lot of people like your parents spend time in the winter trapping then?
Yeah. Yeah, everybody trapped. Most of the people here trapped and fish in the summertime, you know. Yeah.
And did men and women trap together, or?
Well, the women done probably the skinning, so quite a bit of the skinning, and stayed home and kept the fires going, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Wintertime is cold. And some of them had kids to take care of, you know, young kids, younger than school age. Yeah.
But they would stay up near the trap lines?
Pardon?
They would stay up near the trap lines?
Oh, yeah, they had cabins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There was a lot of cabins along the river. I remember when I first started moose hunting. Gosh, there was cabins every few bends in the river. You know, trappers. They had their trap line right there. They were good log cabins, nice and cozy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what time of year did people stay up there in those cabins?
Wintertime.
Right, when they come back.
They'd go up in the fall with a grub stake, and some you never see again till spring. Some of them came down and sell their furs and went right back. Maybe do a little shopping. And then in the spring they'd come down and go fishing. And that was kind of the routine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what all was in those grub stakes? What did they bring up there?
Oh, gee, they had... them days, everything, we had no refrigeration. Of course, bacon didn't need refrigeration or hams. But they had a lot of things in salt barrels.
Mm, wow.
In brine. Butter came in brine. Several types of meat, spare ribs and all kinds of stuff came salted. And then in addition to that, my dad, he salted beaver and salted ducks before he got a canner, and then he used to can ducks and geese.
Mm-hmm.
But it was good food.
Yeah,
not like
good.
Now. Yeah, not too much junk food these days. Things were cheap in a store. Nickel for a bar of candy. I think it was 15 cents for a bottle of pop. You go to a movie for... they had... Dillingham had two movie halls.
Wow.
Back then. Low Trading Company and Felder Gale. And they'd alternate. One week they'd have a... Wednesdays and Saturdays they'd have movies in one theater, and then the next Wednesday and Saturday in the other theater. They had cowboy shows and all kinds of movies, you know. They shipped them in on a boat, and they were tapes. Yeah.
Did a lot of people show up at those?
Oh, yeah.
Films?
Sometimes it was packed. Yeah. Yeah. In that Low Trading Company, they had the Lowe's Igloo Theater, name of it. It was a pretty big place, on a balcony, and you used to have the Christmas programs there.
Oh, wow.
The school, because there was no gym then. And that'd be a packed house feed. The high school kids went out and cut a tree, Christmas tree, and it was damn near tall as the ceiling. Yeah, and everybody brought their presents there, and kids hand them out, yeah. Sometimes you get a lengthy program, other times it was 2-3 hours.
Wow.
It was nice, yeah.
And where was that building? Is it still standing?
No, they tore it down. It was right around where Delta Western is now, their office, right around that vicinity. Yeah. Yeah.
And so most of the commercial fishing people who came up in the summer, were they still there in the winter, or mostly they left? And
oh, they left, them outside fishermen. They came up for the fishing season, and then they left. Yeah. And quite a few of the Canada workers came from the Kuskokwim and the Yukon River.
Oh.
Yeah, mostly native. Quite a few natives. What they had... Filipinos, Japanese, Chinese, you know, it was, I guess in the early days, most of the Canada workers came from San Francisco, Orientals, you know. Yeah, some of them stayed, some of them raised families here, some of them left, you know. Yeah. Yeah. Then we got airports here, and everybody didn't have to go out by boat to Seattle or San Francisco. Went by boat.
When did that happen?
Oh, we started getting a good airport here in the early 50s. They started building this airport. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And before that, we only had that 800-foot strip uptown.
Hmm.
Short. Yeah.
So the canneries were still shipping people up on boats in the 40s then, it sounds like?
Or? Oh, yeah. 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 They're just starting to fly people in then, in about the 40s. Yeah.
When did everyone get refrigerators? You were talking about all the salted foods. When did that change?
Oh, Nushigak Electric started here, oh, I think it was in the 50s. And then people started getting refrigerators, you know, maybe you didn't have to hunt so much.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a good thing. And you could preserve your moose and whatever small game you got, you know, berries, fish. Yeah. Yeah. Flick the switch and turn the light on. Yeah.
So most people in the 40s, they didn't have electricity?
No. Those in, well, we didn't have it. Yeah.
And where was your family living at that time?
In the Akanakanak.
Akanakanak. In Olsonville?
Yeah. Yeah. I remember Red Tilden talking about cutting the first light poles for Dillingham. They're all gone now. But it was native spruce.
Mm.
Yeah. They cut several hundred logs or spruce poles. Yeah. And then Nishigak eventually went to creosote treated stuff.
Mm.
No maintenance, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, times have changed. Now we get flights, 3-4 flights a day here.
Yeah.
And we get almost the same day service from Seattle. Where you could leave New York and one early morning and almost make it home. One day. Red Flensburg, he was the early bird pilot here. He had an air taxi. And he mentioned to some people, local people here, he says, pretty soon you're going to make Seattle in one day. And they thought he was crazy. You know, at that time, you flew a small plane through Lake Clark Pass and into Anchorage. If the weather was bad, you were stuck. on either end. And they start flying direct from Seattle to Anchorage, and then the jets came, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot of changes. I've seen a lot of changes.
When did the telephones come in?
When did the telephones come? Late 60s. Everybody was on a party line. And when it rained, you had bad reception. I don't know why. Yeah. Yeah, it got better, way better after Michigan Electric took over. Michigan Telephone. Yeah.
So how did people learn about news all over this area?
We had no TV, no telephones. Our only news we had is if you had a good antenna, you hooked up antenna and you got Anchorage station for the news.
Oh.
Yeah. Nowadays, gee whiz. We used to see kids playing outside. Nowadays, they're inside watching TV, yeah, or tapes or whatever, yeah.
No internet back then.
No internet either, no. So Bristol Bay Native Corporation, on its first annual meeting, gave out prizes, door prizes, and a couple of from a guy from Kalinganak won a TV. They had a TV set, but no TV.
When was that, Ofi?
What the heck? 73, I think it was. Anyway, what the heck is the name of that? AT&T. I forgot what they call the Alaska division of it. But anyway, they were putting in dishes in the villages about that time. And so the guy had the TV for about a year, maybe 2 years, up in Kalinganak. And what they called, they had one telephone. It was in the store up there. And they called Kalinganak, and they said, the TV's on. And this guy had the only TV in the village. So he turned it on, nice big screen. And his house just filled up with kids, you know. They were, oh, that was a day. That changed everything, I think.
How many channels did you get back then?
You know, I don't remember. The first TV from Dillingham was relayed through King Salmon. King Salmon Armed Forces Radio. They had a relay station up here at Black Point and another one behind Portage. It was pretty good entertainment, black and white.
And you were living in Kalinganak at that time?
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe you could tell us how you wound up going from Kanakanak to Kalinganak.
Well, my wife was up a river, and we had some good friends. We used to go up there quite a bit. And we both wanted to move up there. And we spent 6 years. We built a small cabin and spent about 6 years up there. Yeah. Kids were all born up there. Well, they were born in the hospital, but we were living up there when they were born. Yeah.
And how did you meet your wife?
I met her in Ikwok. Yeah. That's where she was from. Yeah.
And what were you doing in Ikwok at the time?
We were living in a cabin, my uncle and I, down below, trapping. And we went up there for something. I forget what it was. Yeah. Iqaluit was a pretty big village then, you know, a lot of people living there. Most of them old timers are gone now. Mm. Yeah. If you need anything, a guy had a small store there. Yeah. Yeah.
So how old were you and what time of year was this? Must have been wintertime somewhere, but.
Yeah, when it was like 23. Yeah. It wasn't a wintertime. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so do you remember where you were when you first met your wife?
In Iqaluit.
Yeah, just around town or?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then how much longer after that did you get married?
A couple of years. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you get married down here in Dillingham?
Or? Yeah, down here in Dillingham. Dillingham Courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, quick and easy marriage. Huh. Yeah. One of the things that really changed Dillingham was this road to Electigic.
Mm-hmm.
They built that road in the early 50s. And of course, it was just a muddy road then. The only time you could travel on it when it was dry, it was full of holes. And then they eventually... It was like that for quite a few years. And they eventually upgraded, gravel it, and then now it's paved.
Yeah.
22 miles of road, I think it is. And it's a beautiful drive.
It sure is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, did everyone want that road to Iqaluit? I mean, to, I'm sorry, to Electigic?
I never heard any controversy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I think people wanted it. When they made that road, they bulldozed the wood on the side. And talk about wood. People were out there loading their pickup trucks up with wood. It was just handy. You backed up to it and saw it in chunks and load up and come home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
For how long has there been talk about maybe roads to connect up with the road system? Was that always something that was people talked about or?
That started with the Hammond administration, believe it or not.
Hmm.
They had a guy there, DOT commissioner, and he talked about the road from here to Anchorage.
Mm.
But it's so expensive, I don't think we'll ever get it. It's millions of dollars a mile. Mm. That's too damn much. Oh. People say it will be cheaper goods here, but at gas, it's $7.07 a gallon. I don't see it. No, the cheapest way to get stuff in here is by boat. Yeah. I guess if the road was paved and stuff like that, but you don't build a road and pave it right away. Yeah.
When did the community start growing in the way that it did? You said it was 500 people when you first remember. Now it's...
There was about 500 people here, I think. Yeah. Of course, the Dillingham, Wood River, Squaw Creek. There was no road to Electigic then. And then Kanakanak. People living along the road and both ends of the road.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when did it start to really grow? Or was it sort of just gradual?
Yeah, I think it was probably in the 70s, 60s, late 60s, 70s. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Any reason why?
I think after the state, after they found oil up in Prudhoe Bay and got some money from the state, I think we saw a lot of changes, you know.
Mm.
Better airports, schools, just about everything was impacted by that oil boom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. State was rich back then. Yeah.
And so how old were you around that time and what were you up to?
When they found oil?
Yeah.
Oh, I was about 30.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a chance to go on the pipeline, but I didn't go. I stayed here and fished. Yeah. But just about anybody who wanted to work up there can work. If you know how to start a piece of machinery, you were hired. Yeah. The hospital grew, you know. I remember a time when he had only one doctor down there and a small crew. Now I don't know how many doctors we got. We got a dental clinic. You know, that place really grew. I think there's about 400 employees down there, I think. More if you count the health aides in the villages. Yeah, that place really grew. Behind the hospital, towards the vortex site, those duplexes were never there. Mm. They built them in the 60, I think, 61. And used to, when I was a young kid, I used to ski behind there, hunt ptarmigan. good, especially when it's snowing and blowing, ptarmigan, there was shelter in there. It was a pretty good open spot.
Mm-hmm.
They built them houses and sure changed things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe you could tell us also when you started to get involved in the BBNC and in, sounds like you were involved in fishing for quite some time.
Well, I first started fishing in late 1940s. My parents in Setnet. Yeah.
Where did you do that?
Huh?
Where did you Setnet?
Down here at the Limit Stake. They had they had Setnets all the way up to Snake Point.
Mm.
All on down there. And they moved the Limit Stake down there. But my dad and mom both had Setnet sites down there. And then they moved to Igushik. Yeah.
Did your mom have family who, or did they have family in Igushik or who went to
Igushik? She was born down there.
Oh, she was?
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So did your whole family go down to Igoushik then for the
The whole
summers?
family, yeah. Yeah. Monkey boat from the cannery came. Power 36-foot boat moved us down there. Yeah. At that time, you were company fishermen. You belonged to the company. They furnished everything. Nets, everything. Yeah, it was pretty good. Yeah.
And what company did you guys fish for?
Alaska Packers, Clark's Point. Yeah. That was a big operation back then. Oof. In the 40s, I don't know how many lines they had, but two mess halls, a lot of people working there. Yeah.
Tell us more about what that was like when you first started doing that. Did you first start with going with your dad?
Yeah, I worked on a set net. Yeah, with my dad and mom. Yeah.
Did your dad drift at all?
Oh, yeah, he drifted. Yeah. I went with him part of a year when I was young man. Yeah.
Okay, so you were describing what it was like fishing for Alaska Packers in the 40s.
Well, at that time, you were required to go and get the cannery ready. Work, if you were a fisherman, you worked in a cannery. They call it run money. Whatever the cannery wants you to do, you worked. And you got paid, I don't know, $100, $200 for 2 weeks' work. And in the same way in the fall, after fishing, you had to load the salmon cases. And that took about 2 weeks, I guess. But anyway, the company furnished everything, furnished you a boat. If you were a set net, they furnished you a skiff. And I don't remember, a kicker, I think, I don't know if they furnished you an outboard motor. Maybe they did. And if you ruined a net, you went into a company and got a new net. Linen nets, they rotted faster. And you fished 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, Monday through Saturday morning. Yeah.
When did that change?
Well, that changed in the 50s. We started to get those poor fishing seasons, poor returns, and they went to 2 days a week, and some districts were even closed. It was so low a run, and then 2 days a week. Oh, my God, I know it went to 4 days a week. And then 2 days a week, and now it's hours. You know, 8 hours, 4 hours, whatever it is nowadays. There's so many fishermen. Oh, yeah.
And in the 50s, when there were those bad runs, were people really worried at the time, or did
Oh,
they?
yeah. In the 60s, you mean?
Or even in the 50s, you said
Oh
when there
yeah.
were.
Oh yeah. At that time, you blamed all the poor runs on the Japanese high seas out here, but now you
Oh.
can't blame it on them.
So you blamed it more on the Japanese high seas fishing than you did on the federal government.
Yeah. Before it was a state here, the feds managed the fishery. They had a fish commissioner, I guess he announced the times you could go fishing. Of course, it was all week. Yeah. Better managed now with the state. at least the local people got an advisory committee and they can go there and make proposals or suggest changes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they always say that more local people got involved during World War II in the fishing industry here, but obviously there were some people involved earlier, like your dad. So maybe tell us how local involvement changed over the years.
Well, when the canneries first started here, they wouldn't hire any locals. I don't think they even got a job. Unless you were like my grandpa, I guess. He was pretty well known, you know. And it went long like that for many years. And during World War II, from what I hear, they were short of manpower. And that's when they started hiring the natives to in a fish boat and more workers in a cannery. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, why was your grandfather? Tell us more about your grandfather. You said he was well known.
Well, he came up here in 1902. He didn't stay the first few years. I think he didn't stay until 1910, 11. And married a local gal. And he was the ninth member of the Alaska Fishermen's Union.
Oh, wow.
And so he was... He was kind of known, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was wasn't from here. He was from Sweden.
What was his name?
Ernest. Ernest Olson.
And who did he marry? What was your grandma's name?
He married Olga Nelson, another Norwegian family down here. And they had a lot of kids, and they had, my grandma was one of two sisters, I think. He married her. They had a dozen kids. Yeah.
And that was your dad's father.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So your grandfather then, he fished on a sailboat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he fished on a sailboat all his life. Yeah. Yeah.
And what was the cannery like? You said there were two mess halls. Were they different?
At Clark's Point, yeah, there was two mess halls there. There was a regular mess hall. And then behind the cannery was a native mess hall, cannery workers' mess hall. And both of them, when they were canning fish, was open all night. It was, like I say, it was a big operation there. They put up a lot of canned salmon, you know. That's all they done. Yeah. Alaska Packers.
And did your grandfather fish for Alaska Packers too?
He fished for, I think, Libby's. And I don't know who else he fished for. He must have fished for a variety of canneries. When I first remember, when I was a little kid, there was four canneries here. There was Libby's Eacock, Alaska Packers, Clark's Point, Peter Pan, they call it PAF in them days, and Bristol Bay Packers at where Bristol Alliance is operating. I used to watch them tow the sailboats out. Man, a long string sometime. Yeah. Yeah.
So how old were you when you first went on a drift boat?
I was 13. was I 14? Yeah.
And that was with your dad.
Yeah. We had an outboard motor alongside. When it was, the wind was blowing, we'd sail. When the dead calm, we'd start the motor. Mm. Yeah.
So what year was that?
52, I think it was. Or was it 53?
So that was just the beginning of the outboard motors, right?
Yeah. Bringing up power. Power came in 51. And that made a dramatic change on the fishery here. You know, power, what the heck? Yeah.
Did your dad, did he want power to come in?
Oh, yeah. 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 They voted for power, I guess. I don't know what was the results. You could run the Naknek and Igigig and all over. Yeah. There were some private power boats before that, though. You know, I never used them in the fishery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of the locals had power boats. Yeah. All wooden boats back then.
Mm-hmm.
No fiberglass, no aluminum. Yeah.
When did that change?
Aluminum boats came in, I think, the 60s. Early 60s, 60, 1960. Yeah. Same with fiberglass. Came in about 1960. Yeah. That made another drastic change. Because you didn't have to paint them, you know. You didn't, no maintenance. Less maintenance you have, the better. Yeah.
Do you remember painting the boats a lot when they were?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You have to paint the sailboat and paint the skiffs. And, yeah.
That was your job?
We used to go to the cannery. I remember when I first started fishing. You looked at your boat. If it needed painting, you painted. I managed to paint my boat every other year. And so you'd go a few days early in May, latter part of May. You'd paint the boat, pour some water in it, soak it up, let the wood soak and the corking. And a day or two, it soaked right out. Okay, you'd go to the store. Get your groceries, a box of groceries. You'd go to the office and get your fish license. And they launched the boat and went fishing on the, by the first part of June, Fish Kings here. That was 5 days a week. And it was like clockwork. Then, oh gee, in the '80s, I think there was too many fishermen. They cut back on the king openings.
Mm-hmm.
Too much pressure on them. Yeah.
So tell us how there got to be so many more boats over the years. Huh? I said, tell us how there came to be so many more boats.
Well, a lot of people ordered boats. Got new boats every so often. But I think the most change came with limited entry. Yeah. Limited entry, authorized 1800 and some, 1800 plus fishermen with permits. And that's quite a number. That's mm-hmm. quite a number. Plus 1,100 set nets. The set net fishery years ago was with widows and housewives and young kids, elderly people. Now you got high-speed outboard skiffs, 100, 200 horsepower on them, six people on board, and they're like a machine, man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the every piece of beach is taken up by set netters now. Limited entry said before limited entry we had 350 set nets in the whole bay. The whole bay. Along comes limited entry and they said, well, we're gonna have an optimum 800 set nets. Well, by the time it was all over, we had 1,100 set nets.
Wow.
Yeah. Of course, all the good sites were taken then.
Mm-hmm.
By then. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if there are going to be any changes to this fishery or not. I imagine there will be. Yeah.
What are you thinking might be the biggest changes that you foresee?
Pardon?
I said, what seem like the biggest changes that you foresee?
Well, I'll bet you fishermen are gonna, pretty soon they're gonna put in a proposal to have longer nets. They have already, but he hasn't passed.
Mm.
That's one of them. This boat length, mm-hmm. I don't know. Every time Bristol Bay comes up, somebody puts a proposal in to lengthen the boat out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think we got enough. Our boats are big enough now. Turn them loose and they could catch every fish in this bay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we could probably talk a lot more about changes in the fishing industry, but we haven't talked at all about your involvement in the BBNC. How did you first come to be involved in the BBNC?
Well, I was living up in Killigannick. There's an old timer up there by the name of Charlie Nelson. He says, we need somebody to go to the meetings. So I hesitated and finally, I said, Charlie, I'll go. And that was in 73, I think it was. Right after BBNC got organized, not long afterward. And I was on the finance meeting. I wasn't on the board. I was on the finance meeting. I was on the big board, yeah. And 74, 73, they had the first annual meeting, I think it was. I got elected and I stayed there till 2000, and when did I retire? Last year.
Wow. 2013,
I retired from the board, but I was chairman of the BBNC for 28 and a half years.
Wow.
16 of those years was chairman and president.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a lot of responsibility back then. I mean, we had to select 3 million acres of land. We, of course, we didn't get all the money at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Had to borrow money, and it was expensive to organize this. You know, I sure respect Nels Anderson for coming here and organizing the corporation, and of course, Harvey Samuelson, who hired him. And it was a lot of responsibility. People didn't realize how much responsibility we got dropped on us all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we had to look for investments. You know, that wasn't easy. What do you know about corporations? We didn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like a time bomb with certain time limits on everything. Like the enrollment, that had to be done in 2 years.
Mm.
Land selections.
Mm.
Yeah. Plus investments. And then, What did we know about corporations? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. At least I didn't know. Yeah. Yeah.
And how did you figure out the land selections?
We had some good people there. We had William Johnson and several other locals. And, you know, it had to be compact and contiguous. And so along with the villages, we managed to select some of the better lands.
Yeah. What criteria were you using to think about? Was it
hunting and fishing? Subsistence was a priority. Maybe for development, a little development. What else was there? A lot of people had knowledge of the outlook of the, the outlook of the land.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you feel like those lands were good selections that have?
Yeah. You know, if they had to be compact and contiguous, you couldn't, they had to be connected, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think they done okay. One of the things I think the land claims left out was subsistence sites.
Mm.
You know, there's areas where villages practice their subsistence lifestyle, and they could have had some subsistence sites.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that compact and contiguous made extra complications. In China.
Oh, yeah. 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 Yeah.
And do you think that things with the BB&C have changed a lot over the years? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Changed quite a bit. When I was there, we had started out with 13, 14 employees. Now we got about 50.
Wow.
In the central office. Yeah, it's grown quite a bit. Yeah, it's grown from, might as well say zero. Well, the government gave us $32 million. That was the cash settlement.
Mm-hmm.
And when that was invested, that was kind of gone.
Mm-hmm.
And now BB&C is almost $2 billion corporation.
Wow.
$2 billion. Yeah. Way windy, huh?
Yeah, really windy. And some of your early investments were they in fisheries, or that was just one little slice? I remember.
Yeah. In 1975, we purchased Peter Pan Seafoods. And in 1979, we sold it. That was a kind of a heartbreaker. Peter Pan was a pretty big outfit, but it was owned by the Bez family, and they wanted to get out of it. They were getting up there in age, and So our manager at that time, Bob Bacon, he negotiated a price with them, and we purchased the company, everything, lock, stock, and barrel. Never made any money. The only time we made money is when we had a fire at King Cove. And when a cannery burned down. We were faced back then with 22% interest rates. 22%. Had a couple of botulism cases.
Yeah. Right.
I was in Europe. Lucky it was in Europe.
Right.
Yeah.
So that made things pretty difficult, it sounds like.
Pretty difficult, yeah. And at that time, when we bought Peter Pan, or purchased Peter Pan, the banks in Seattle financed the PAC loan. Hmm. The PAC loan being the canned salmon. And as your inventory went down, you paid the bank back. And they changed that. The banks came to us in Seattle and says, hey, if you want to get financed, you gotta finance about half of it. Mm. Half the PAC loan. Peter Pan didn't have the money. Then it was 22% interest rates, the Carter years. What would they call that? Prime rate was about 22%. And it was just killing us. So we had to make up our mind, either sell Peter Pan or bankrupt BBNC. Mm.